Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for being here this late in the day, and I feel honored to be in this panel. And I was really excited when this section was introduced as the edgiest and most politically insightful one. So I feel very honored to be in that group, and I hope that I can contribute to that. So in my abstract, I had talked about doing a small piece of actually what I'm going to do. So this is really going to be the first official presentation of some of my dissertation work, because I went beyond what I had decided to do for today. So the title that you see is the title of my dissertation. And if you know anything about sociologists, we have these very long titles because we try to tell you what we're talking about and how we're going to do it. So what I did is I was looking at the social transformation of really the discourse about health disparities and inequities and how the term disparities became dominant in the discourse. So what I did is I took a look from 1970 to 2010, which is similar to what Nkasar was doing, because it's a very significant period in our history. And I came up with the idea that the result of these 40 years of policy really is that we have erased social justice from policy in health in the United States. And in reality, what happens is, who did that erasing? And I believe that academia and people in policy in U.S. government are responsible for doing this. So in my dissertation, my objectives were to find out how social justice was erased from the narrative and work on the social determinants of health, and then to map the social and intellectual history of the social determinants of health, which my mentor calls is a history of forgetting and remembering. And again, is that there have been times when the social determinants of health and the ideas of social justice were present in our society, and there have been other times when they have been forgotten. And I would say that right now is a period when they are forgotten. So I just quickly want to talk about the difference in the definitions between disparities, inequalities, and inequities. And as you know, most of the discourse, we hear the word disparity and disparities. And to me, they were defined in a way that was very reductionist, because they only talk about differences in health outcomes between racial and ethnic populations. But it doesn't really address what the causes of those differences are, whether they are just or not. They are just differences. And then there's health inequalities that are differences in health outcomes, and they are linked to socioeconomic factors. And finally, inequities is the term that really looks at differences in resources that are linked to an uneven distribution of money and power. And this gets us to the neoliberal capitalism that the two gentlemen before me were talking about. So, as a sociologist, we do have a conceptual development, and mine is based on health is not a luxury or a commodity. It shouldn't be. It shouldn't be that only those people who can afford to pay for it have good health. It should be accessible to all of us. And pay attention that I am saying health, not just health care, but health in a broader sense. That is a social justice issue, because for me, equity equals social justice. And that is based on the social determinants of health. And I know that you have seen this chart millions of times, but what I want you to notice is that the political system is missing from this chart, if you see how it is, that the individual is still at the center of the graphic. So my research question was, how was the social construction of health disparities among racial, ethnic, and other disadvantaged populations accomplished and implemented? And I had two arguments. And the first one is that the politics and policies of health disparities preempt social change because they focus on individual lifestyle changes and personal responsibility. Therefore, they really do not require system change. Because if you blame the individual, the one that has to change is the individual and nothing else. And the second is that the hegemonic disparity construction is very much congruent with the demands of a free market economy. So I base this into concepts. Hegemony, which is the dominance of ideas generated by a small power elite. And the power of hegemony is that it spreads to the rest of the population that ends up believing that it's in their best interest, when in reality, it's in the best interest of the elite. And the second one is racial formation, where racial meanings are rearticulated over and over at the individual, collective, and structural levels where economic and political structures are formed. So, as you can see, there's a framing tension in my research. On one side, we have social justice values. On the other one, we have what I call the dominant market justice values. And I'm not going to read these, but you can look at them and see how there really is a tension between them. And there are two very different sides and two very different ways of looking at health. So how did I go about doing this? Well, one of the things that I like to do is study up, which is, again, something that my mentor and chair, who is actually present here, Dr. Howard Waitzkin, taught me for the first time when I went back to school. And it's really very difficult to find data about the elites. You know, we don't have data sets that tell us about what they think or how they come up with their ideas, as opposed to we're so used to having Latinos and blacks and the poor being studied that we know everything about them. But we don't really know anything about the elites. So I had to do more of a qualitative analysis, although there is a piece of quantitative analysis that I did. So my analysis had to do with two things. First, I analyzed official government reports because they are discourse. And this is discourse that really drives not only policy, but interventions. And I looked at the Healthy People reports. If you're familiar with them, they are written every 10 years. So the report that was written in 1979, 1980, really sets the policy in health for the next 10 years. And the one in 1990 goes up until 2000 and on and on. And I also looked at the World Health Report in 2000 because I wanted to have somewhat of an international comparison, and I will tell you why. I also looked at an Institute of Medicine report in 2003 that was very influential called Unequal Treatment, and a report of the Agency for Healthcare and Research Quality. And now I'd like to tell you a story of why I got interested in this subject. And the first was that there was a story that this report, the ARC report of 2003, was really commissioned first by the Clinton administration. And it was the first time that we looked at disparities in the nation, health disparities. But then what happened is the Bush administration came in, and when they published the report, they changed it. So there were all kinds of accusations that the Bush administration was ignoring science, not paying attention to science, which is all true in that case. But then one of the staffers, somebody at a pretty high level, who I don't really know who it is and nobody has told me, leaked the report to the New York Times so that the public was aware of what the real report was. And what the Bush administration officials had done was, instead of showing the real disparities, they tried to minimize them. And they didn't even call them disparities. They decided that that was too strong a word, so they called them differences. The other thing is that they didn't show the disparities. They tried to show all the positive things. So if there was any area in which blacks were doing better, that's what they emphasized and publicized. So I got really curious about how does this happen? How come some people have the power to do that? When we think as scientists and researchers, what we do is rigorous, And we consider it to really represent what's happening at the time, and yet somebody can come in and change it overnight. The other thing is that the disparities term really came into popularity during the Clinton administration, during the last years of the Clinton administration. And that was also very curious, because as you saw from my definition, disparities really doesn't talk about causes. It doesn't really talk about whether they are fair or not, or whether they should be. Really, they are just differences that happen. And if you recall, some of you may recall, the Clinton administration had President Clinton, who was called the first black president because he was very supportive of blacks. He was very interested in looking at the condition of blacks, and he really instituted several programs to establish dialogue and to talk about race and racism. There were things that were not talked about in the past. He also had a very strong cabinet. He had a very strong congressional black caucus. He had a Surgeon General, Dr. David Satcher, who is black. And he really had what I call kind of the perfect combination to get a lot done, especially since this was his last chance after the healthcare reform. It was dead on arrival, if you remember. That's what we used to call it. So how come when these people with so much power are apparently they had a coalition around them that would support them, how come they settled for disparities in the discourse? How come they didn't go for at least inequalities? Or how come they didn't even think about equity and inequity? So I wanted to find out, what were they thinking? And where did the, how did these ideas come to be the dominant? And how come that discourse has lasted until very recently? So I, other than the documents, I also decided to interview some key informants. So what I did is I looked at the reports that were written and in the late 1990s and trying to find who was involved. If you know about Healthy People reports, they are really the result of many players bringing their ideas into these reports. But they are mostly academics that write the ideas, and their papers and their ideas are background for these reports. So what I did is I looked at the names, and I made a small list to begin with. And then I asked them to give me other names. And I ended up interviewing 16 people, all of whom, most of them are MDs and PhDs. None of them are less than a PhD. About half of them work as in policy and academia. Some of them in academia, but do background work for the policies that we have. And I have a mix of male, female, black and white, and Latinos. So I wanted to ask them what happened during the 1990s. What were the definitions of disparities? And whether the discourse that they use has changed since that time. So what I'm presenting today are very preliminary findings. I am still looking at my data. I have gone through the coding and finding the themes. So I'm going to talk about some interesting things. And I didn't know how much time we have, but I think I'm doing okay.
At least 5 minutes, maybe a little more.
Okay. So looking at the language, the discourse, since that's something that I am fascinated by, in fact, the word disparities really became very much in vogue and used during the late 1990s and has continued to be very popular until very recently. Healthy People 2020, which is being developed now, is built on an equity frame. And if you look at Healthy People 2020, you will find the word equity much more often, and you hardly ever find the word disparities. In Healthy People 2000, which has guided our policies until now, you find the word disparities at least 3 times in every page. In terms of definitions, the way that disparities are defined is all over the map. And what I found interesting is that when I was talking to the key informants, most of these people, or all of them actually, are what I would call progressive. They are all highly educated and highly knowledgeable. And when I asked them how come disparities was the term that was used, I get answers from, we call them disparities, but everybody knew that they were unjust. Everybody knew that they were not natural, and everybody knew that we could do something about them. I said, but you didn't say it. And they didn't say it. And that's one of the findings that I'm fascinated by, is that we know what we need to say. And when it comes to the social determinants of health, we understand what they mean, and yet we don't talk about them. And when we do, we're considered edgy and politically insightful, when it really should be something that in public health, in medical sociology, in all these professions, it should be part of our regular vocabulary. So clearly the discourse has changed, and it's interesting too when I interviewed these informants that it's hard to look at what you were thinking in 1999 and 2000 and before in view of what you're thinking today. So it was sometimes difficult because people kept talking about inequity and inequality as if they had talked about it in the 1990s when they really didn't. So, for example, there are a lot of contradictions, both in the documents and in the interviews, because on the one hand, I think everybody that I interview had some awareness of the social determinants of health and how personal responsibility, individual responsibility, lifestyle are all code for, you know, not having any government responsibility or collective responsibility. So, for example, in Healthy People 1990, which remember was written between 1979 and 1980, there is a statement that says, to imply that personal behavior choices are entirely within the power of the individual is misleading. Now, you don't hear that today. You didn't hear it in 2000, but it was there in 1990. And yet, when I looked at, okay, so what solutions do they propose? There was very little about changing the environment, changing the system. There was a little bit of that. But it's almost like it got said and then it just disappeared. Then I looked at Healthy People 2000, and this is one statement. Personal responsibility, responsible and enlightened behavior by each and every individual truly is the key to good health. Our physical and emotional well-being is dependent on measures that only we ourselves can affect. So here we see the personal responsibility at its worst or best. So of course we all understand that we all need to feel agency and personal responsibility, but somehow the people in power don't feel that personal responsibility. And then I have one area that is called quotable quotes. And again, this one says, until the Reagan years, our health indicators were improving and even some disparities were closing. And then when the deregulation happened, you see that all health indicators, disparities and inequities are widening. So there's a real awareness of what's happening. This is another one. My experience in having to be so careful about my discourse in this country, unable to really communicate differently when I was working with people at the WHO, the World Health Organization. Now, this is a person that had worked in this country and then had worked in Europe and in Latin America, where the discourse is very different. Because I don't know if you are aware of this, but in Europe, they don't talk about disparities. Neither do we in South America. We don't even have a word for disparidad. I'm from Colombia. We call about desigualdad. We call about igualdad, which is equality. And we don't really talk about inequity that much, but we call mostly about equality and inequality, but never about disparity. And yet, when those academics, when they write papers in Europe or in Latin America, they're using the language of equity and inequity and inequality. But when they come here, as this person said, I had to be so careful about the language that I use. And that was one of my first interviews, and I didn't ask this person, how come you had to be so careful? What stopped you from saying those words when you came to this country? And I asked that to some people later, because I got better as I went along. So one of the things, as I said, this is very preliminary, but one of the things that I kept hearing was that if you talk about inequality or inequity, it won't fly. Several people said those actual words. It just won't fly. And I don't know about you, but when you see something won't fly, it's like you have a perception that if you say it, people are going to stop you or they're not going to hear you. But they weren't giving any evidence that this was happening. And then there was somebody who said, well, you know, we couldn't talk about that because we have to choose whether to change something or whether to be right. And I chose to just try to change something. But these are the people that never wrote about inequality or inequity. They kept talking about disparities, and they didn't bother to really define them in a way that would make people think about context and think about the social determinants of health, and they all know about it. But it's this self-censoring that happens. Before you even open your mouth, you don't allow yourself to say something. And then somebody said that, how come? How come it wouldn't fly here? How come we don't talk about it? And several people talk about, well, it has to do with our value system, where we believe, like this person says, and even now, people are ambivalent about embracing an explicit definition that says that disparities and equity are about disadvantage. And I think it gets to that profoundly American handicap, which is the belief that the individual is responsible for everything and that societal responsibility is minimal. Somebody else said health disparities are really healthcare disparities, and they are narrowly focused on race. So even though actually this is the same person that earlier said everybody knew that these were unjust, everybody knew they were not a natural happening, and everybody knew that we could do something about it. But yet, later on, this person says that they were really narrowly focused on race and not on anything else. So the quotable quotes and the contradictions continue both throughout the document and throughout the interviews. So in terms of my conclusions, and I have not written my conclusions chapter yet, one of the things that I found out, not only when I did the content analysis for the words, I got really curious about what are the words don't we use, because I use critical discourse analysis. And this is not part of what I set out to do, but just out of curiosity, I looked for social justice in all the documents, and I found that it was never mentioned. And we are looking at documents from 1970 to 2010. Except for very few scholars, the sociological literature also neglects to talk about social justice. And another word that we don't use at all is racism. We use race, but we don't use racism. Class is used very little because, as most of you know, we don't believe in classes in the United States. And actually, in the interviews, almost every person that I interviewed said this, of course, in a sarcastic way. So I think that the whole idea of social justice, which to my surprise, and I don't know about you, but it was only about 3 years ago that I discovered that social justice was a contested concept. Did you all know that? I mean, to most, I don't know. To me, it was always like common sense that social justice should be something that we all think is a good thing. It's like good health, right? It's like having enough to eat. And yet, in this country, it's a very contested concept, and I'm beginning to look at some of the papers that write about that. So social justice, what I am beginning to conclude is that really incompatible with neoliberal values, namely a political economy based on market values, and that we are, at some level, so afraid to even think about what it means to think outside the box, that we censor ourselves before the ideas come out of our mouths, so we don't even say it. Also, we are able to talk about social determinants of health, but as a lot of you probably have heard, and I have heard at these conferences and the sociology conferences and many forums that I go to, is we talk about the social determinants of health, and we can still not include social justice in them. So we can talk about equity, which I have heard in the last couple of years, and still equity doesn't include the spirit of equity, which means equality of resources. But we can still say the words, but we have taken away the social justice piece out of those words. And therefore, social determinants of health are not a real good proxy for social justice. And this is where the scholar activist in me comes out. And I really believe that we need to start speaking what we know to be truth, and that if reality can be constructed by this elite in a way that is totally incongruent with what we think and believe, we can begin to change that reality and change that discourse by using the words that we seem to be afraid to use, and that we don't censor ourselves any longer when we are talking, especially in a forum like these conferences, when most people probably would agree with us. Thank you.